Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 1st, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And joining us later on the program will be Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI and Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll hear from Mike Dean at the State House and Eve Zuckoff, WCAI's environmental reporter. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. Jeff, one of your beats at the Times is local politics. It's a great week to have you on because there are a couple of stories there to talk about. Let's start with the state Senate seat that will soon be vacated midterm by the retirement of Vinnie DiMacedo. This week, candidates for the seat started popping out all over, it seemed like.
Oh, they have, Steve. And, you know, it's just a little over 2 weeks now since Senator DiMacedo announced that he would be leaving office to take a job at Bridgewater State University. And it didn't take long for several candidates to decide, you know, this may be my chance. And they made their intentions known this week. The first one to hear on the Cape that came out and said she was running is Susan Moran, who's a Falmouth select woman and who's also the Falmouth Assembly of Delegates member here in Barnstable County. She announced earlier in the week. Also, there was an attorney in Pembroke. She's a Democrat, by the way, Susan Moran. Becky Coletta is a Democrat as well. She's from Pembroke, and she's an attorney. She also sits on the Pembroke Planning Board. She's the chairperson and is also a former selectman there. And then we learned on the same day that a member of the Plymouth Board of Selectmen, John Mahoney, also a Democrat, has thrown his hat into the ring.
So this district stretches from Plymouth down into the Upper Cape. It's got Falmouth and Sandwich and Bourne.
Yeah, it's a very interesting district. As it's on both sides of the canal, as you mentioned, the three towns on the Cape. But if you go over the bridge, you have Plymouth, Kingston, and Pembroke. And for really the past quarter century, Plymouth seems to be the power center in this district. There has not been a state senator in this district that has not been from Plymouth since the early 1990s.
And then later this week, we found a couple more candidates coming out.
We did. And one was, I believe on Wednesday, a young man named Thomas Moakley from West Falmouth announced that he would be running. He's 24 years old, a recent graduate of Georgetown, now attending law school at Suffolk at night, working in the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, said he's been very involved in events and committees in Falmouth, and he's used to being the youngest person in the room, and he's all in, too.
And then tell us about McMahon, who's running, too.
Yeah. I mean, this is a Republican seat, and the Democrats, the four Democrats that have announced, they've all said, you know what, this is a great chance to take this back and flip it. But the two leading candidates that you would have thought would have dived right in here would be Representative Dave Vieira from Falmouth, as well as Matt Muratori, who's a state representative from Plymouth, used to have Senator DiMacedo's House seat. Both of them have said, you know what, not doing it. I'm out. But Jay McMahon, who's a trial attorney from Buzzards Bay, he did say that he is running. The name may sound familiar because he was a Republican nominee in 2018 to run against Democrat Maura Healey for Attorney General. Of course, she sailed right through to re-election.
But right now, we don't even know when the special election to fill the seat is going to be. The term runs all the way till the end of 2020. Is that right? But we're waiting to find out when DiMacedo officially resigns, and then they'll figure out when the special election will be?
That's right. And I've had several calls in this week and actually before this week into Secretary of State Galvin's office, Senate President Spilka's office. There is not one place where you can look, Steve, on the state website or at any law or bylaw that says this is the process you need to follow. So it's a bit murky. Karen Spilka, the president of the Senate, will be the one to eventually set the date. But she has to receive an official letter of resignation from Senator DiMacedo's office before that process can start. She has not received that. So I'd asked Senator DiMacedo yesterday, have you sent the letter in? He had not yet, but he says he now has heard that she cannot get this process going until the seat is actually vacated. And he's staying right up until November 20th, which is the end of the legislative session. So she may not be able to even start thinking about this till November 20th.
And then you wonder if they're looking at the primary that comes up in March as a time to get everybody to the polls.
It is. And, you know, it appears as if once he vacates the office, she will have 20 days to set the date of the election. Many people that I've talked with are saying, you know what, from a cost perspective, it makes sense to have this general election. And I believe it's March 2nd, maybe March 3rd, which is when Massachusetts holds its presidential primary, which actually a lot of people are saying there's a lot more interest in that on the Democratic side, so that could benefit the Democratic candidates.
And the seat used to be held by Democrat Teresa Murray.
Teresa Murray for years. I mean, became the Senate president. But then from that date, if she sets that, you have to start working backwards. There has to be a primary at least a month before that date. And then you get into the nitty-gritty when her nomination papers due and all that. So it'll be interesting to see this work out in the next few weeks. And, of course, the candidates have a very compressed you have to run a very compressed campaign here. They also got the holidays thrown in for good measure.
Last week we talked about the passing of Jim Crocker, who was Barnstable Town Council president at the time of his death. You had a chance to go to his funeral. Tell us about this.
I did, and it was an amazing turnout for Jim Crocker. It was in Osterville, Our Lady of the Assumption Church, a parish in which he was very involved most of his life. He was a native of Osterville, standing room only. I got there almost an hour before. Parking was nowhere to be found. Incredible turnout. Very sad, obviously. It was a very sudden passing of Jim. His wife and daughters gave the eulogies. And I'll just mention probably the one that stuck out. I mean, it was very sad. But one of his daughters was talking about her father and said, you know, he didn't have hobbies. He had committees. And which really, to me, just summed that up. He was so involved in Barnstable Town politics for decades. And, you know, he will certainly be missed. And obviously, with the passing of Jim, Steve, big, big void here in the town of Barnstable.
And there's an election coming up here.
To complicate matters worse, you know, more, not only is the loss of Jim a huge change, he was the town council president, really had his hands in every aspect of town government, really led the charge on a lot of new initiatives, including the new wastewater, the billion-dollar project. But now, 2.5 weeks after his death, there's an election, 7 of the 13 precincts in Barnstable. So there could be a significant turnover come Tuesday night in Barnstable, could change the complete makeup of the town council and the direction which will go for the next 4 years. And one of those precincts where there will be election is Jim's. And he had a challenger, David Bogan, fairly newcomer to town. He's an attorney from Connecticut. Does have a home in Osterville. And unfortunately, it was too late to change the ballot. So Jim will still be on the ballot on Tuesday. Town clerk has issued a statement. It will also be available at the polls. He cannot win. I think a lot of people think, I am going to vote for Jim. It'll be a tribute vote. He'll win. Then it will trigger a special election. It's not the way it is because he's deceased at the time of the election. And the way she explained it to me, and it's just kind of sad, you know, if somebody were ill, were in the hospital like Jim, but was still alive, whether it be on life support or not, it would count. But since he had died before the election, it can't. So people, I think, they might want to actually vote for him, but it's going to be a vote that will be counted as a blank.
Yeah.
On Tuesday. But there has been a write-in candidate who has emerged in Osterville. His name is Matthew Driscoll, and he actually is the general manager of the mobile station in the village. So he tells me he's been out campaigning every day as people get gas. And he is saying that, you know, I felt as if I needed to run. I had thought about it in the past, but I'm also a lifelong resident of Barnstable and figured I should give this a shot.
Let's talk about Dennis and Yarmouth approving their new school pact, which any listener of the show knows has been a long and fraught journey. But this week, both towns signed off on it.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, long, long journey. There were simultaneous town meetings in Dennis and Yarmouth on Tuesday night, so I'm guessing they did that so one wouldn't have the jump on the other.
Any kind of advantage there, yes.
Right. Same time, same night. The voters in both towns approved a pact. They're finally on the same page. They're agreeing. Now Dennis will pay a higher share of its cost for the school district. That was the thrust of this whole issue over the past few years. And starting in fiscal year 2021, in addition to the minimum local contribution required by the state, it won't be divided. What they need to pay above and beyond the state contribution won't be divided according to the number of students each town sends to the schools. Dennis sends far fewer students to the high school than Yarmouth does. Currently, it pays for the students that it sends, but in both towns, there are a couple hundred, I believe, students that decide to go to other charter schools or school choice and go to other districts, and Yarmouth picks up the bill for that.
For both towns right now.
So, for both towns.
So they're going to split that. It's called the foundation enrollment, right? Everybody who's involved there.
That's right. So now it's going to be split based on the foundation enrollment over the course of the next 5 years. And for those of you who wonder what a foundation enrollment is, like I have been during this whole process, foundation enrollment actually includes students who live in the two towns but do attend a charter school or another public school. And I believe this costs the district in the coming year about $3.3 million just because the students live in the towns, but they're not going. They have to send funds over to those schools.
Now, I want to touch on the fact that there was an outstanding lawsuit in this situation from the citizens of Yarmouth, a group that got together and sued about the vote that had really approved a new middle school here and sort of precipitated so much of this this renegotiation of the school compact. The lawsuit yesterday was dismissed.
Yeah, but it's the second lawsuit as well. This is all over the plans for a $117 million new regional middle school, and it had passed at the ballot box last year. And some of the people are saying, you know what, you shouldn't have done that. You bypassed town meeting. Such an expenditure, you really needed to go to town meeting. So there was a lawsuit filed. Town of Yarmouth filed the lawsuit initially against the district. That was dismissed. And then yesterday, a very similar lawsuit by some residents of Yarmouth was dismissed as well.
And what the judge says here is quite – there's quite a quote here from the judge.
I have it highlighted too.
Good. You tell us what it is.
If the law generally allowed disappointed voters to bring private suits like this to overturn elections, the result would be chaos.
You can't sue if you don't like the result of the election, basically, is –
That's right.
What that judge is saying. And also there's some question about the timing of all of this for when they filed their lawsuit. But the outcome is that the judge has dismissed that lawsuit. Hey, listen, we have just a few minutes, but I want to talk about the National Seashore, too, which has some big projects on its to-do list. Mm-hmm. Wheeler Copperthwaite wrote the story on this. Tell us about this.
He did, you know, and as we begin to look into the off-season here, things are winding down at the National Seashore, at least for summer activity, but they're really looking forward to next season. And there was a meeting earlier this week where the National Seashore said there's about $10.6 million in major capital projects, which they'll be embarking upon for the next season. Some big ones here and much needed. One is a $5 million project to construct a tide gate at Mill Creek and Wellfleet, which is a larger project we've been hearing a lot about recently on the Herring River down there to increase tidal flow. They're also going to spend $3.6 million on a new parking area and bathhouse at Nauset Light Beach in Eastham, you know, which has suffered from some of the recent nor'easters and storms over the past few years. Another almost $2 million is going to go to repairing the Highland Light in North Truro. And finally, they're going to spend about $150,000 to repair some of the walking trails in the National Seashore, specifically what's called the White Cedar Swamp Trail, which I've never been on, but I want to go.
It's beautiful. I've been there. Listen, one of the things I thought was interesting about this story is that they say that these projects are part of sort of getting to some of the deferred maintenance tasks that they haven't gotten to in a while. But they have an outstanding list of deferred maintenance, and they've been chipping away at it. But at one point, There was a backlog of 600 work tickets waiting to be addressed.
And I looked at that, too. I'm like, wow, 600. And they say they've got it down to about 70. So there's been a lot of work going on down there at the National Seashore. But even after these projects for the next season, they say they still have about $50 million in deferred maintenance projects that they still need to get to. And I should mention they're all doing this as the Volunteer Seashore Commission still remains in limbo. When the Trump administration came into office in 2017, they began to review federal advisory commissions. And this group really hasn't had the chance to meet. They haven't had permission to meet.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Time has been Jeff Spillane. Jeff, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me in the studio right now is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And on the phone with us is Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. Hey, Noah.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Noah, let's just set this up here. Another big wind farm may be coming to the waters south of Martha's Vineyard. This week, the state announced the selection of an offshore wind company for the area. Sarah, let me get to you first. Tell us what the state announced, basically.
Sure. So the state announced that Massachusetts utilities companies had selected a second company called Mayflower Wind to create another 800-megawatt offshore wind farm just south of Martha's Vineyard. Mayflower Wind was part of the state's bidding process for a second wind farm back in August of this year. And if listeners remember, their proposal included four different options, some that simply offered what they said was the cheapest rate ever offered for offshore wind in Massachusetts, and others with a higher rate but with promises to build out more offshore wind infrastructure within the state. And in the end, the state chose the option with simply the cheapest rate. And while they aren't releasing exact prices, they say it is indeed the cheapest price offered for offshore wind, much cheaper than what was offered, or maybe not much cheaper, but they say cheaper than what was offered by Vineyard Wind so far and what was also offered by the competing company Bay State Wind, which is owned by Ørsted.
Noah, lay out for us the scope and scale of what Mayflower is proposing.
So they're proposing an 804-megawatt wind farm. It's going to be approximately 20 miles south of the two islands, and it's located pretty much right in between them.
And 800 megawatts, that's kind of what already we're expecting from Vineyard Wind, is that right?
Yeah, the thing is, the way the proposals work is that I think actually each of the companies was required to submit a 400-megawatt bid and an 800-megawatt bid. The one that Vineyard Wind is actually moving forward with, or the first proposed offshore wind farm, is also an 800-megawatt mm-hmm. farm. So in scale, it's similar to the one that we've been talking about with Vineyard Wind. Yeah, that's accurate. At least it would seem to be.
Sarah, this company, Mayflower Wind, what do we know about them and how they got selected in this process?
Sure. So Mayflower Wind may sound like a new company, but they're actually not. They're a subsidiary of Shell Corporation, which I'm sure all of us know, and EDP Renewables, which is a European offshore wind company. And essentially, they say they were able to, or they explain their very cheap rate of offshore wind because they say that they've got the infrastructure from Shell and EDP Renewables already there that will allow them to keep their rates so low. Particularly, Shell already has onshore wind turbines elsewhere in the country, and so they say they can kind of be able to utilize that supply chain, which will allow them to offer offshore wind at such a cheap rate.
As the state was going through the permitting for Vineyard Wind, it was Edgartown got involved in that, Noah, and I'm wondering what the potential impact for Martha's Vineyard is here from this new project Mayflower Wind is proposing.
Well, that's a good question. Right now, it's a little bit unclear. I think plans for how the project is going to be built and how its permitting process is going to go forward, those things are still sort of hazy. We're in the beginning phases of this, so we don't really know. But Mayflower did include a photo on their website where it's more like a map that showed it looks like they at least plan to run a core or a cable, an undersea cable through the Muskegon Channel, similar to the way Vineyard Wind planned to do that, which would mean, at least to me, that the project would probably have to go before the Martha's Vineyard Commission, and if it's close enough to Chappaquiddick, the Edgartown Conservation Commission again. So it seems like even though the wind farm is a little bit southeast of the one Vineyard Wind is proposing, because they're different companies, they're each going to have different infrastructures. And there is a possibility, at least it seems right now, that the infrastructure is going to have to be permitted by at least two regulatory agencies on the island.
Everybody was sounding very upbeat around this announcement, I have to say, especially the state and of course, Mayflower Wind. But it comes at a time when Vineyard Wind's project is just kind of hanging out there with no definite endpoint for getting permitted and moving forward.
Yeah. I guess I spoke with the people at Mayflower Wind about this. I asked, are they worried at all about permitting? And they said no. You know, they said that they felt very strongly that though the setback that Vineyard Wind experienced was unfortunate for the entire industry, they really felt that the federal government would be able to sort all this out and would eventually be able to allow Vineyard Wind and other offshore wind companies to move forward.
Mm. You get that same sense there, Noah?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting also when they made the announcement, I think officials at the state level were saying that, they've already now been through this process or at least part of this process once. And so the sort of impression that they were giving was like, hey, this is something that we can learn from. Lessons have been gained from the Vineyard Wind project. We are going to try and coordinate more up and down the coast. And hopefully that will, I guess, according to them, inform the permitting process at the federal level. But they still were, in their answer, somewhat vague about when the draft environmental impact statement was going to come from the federal government. The federal government's busy with a lot of things right now. So I think there still are questions about how this is going to go forward, at least on the federal level. But on the state level, there was definitely, got that impression too, a ton of enthusiasm.
Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI, thanks for stopping by the studio.
Thanks so much, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, a road improvement project that's already been the source of some controversy will be delayed because of a mistake in the placement of gas lines. Tell us where this is happening and what they've discovered.
Sure. This is the West Chatham Roadway Project. Now, this takes place in the center of the West Chatham Village along Route 28. It's about a 1,700 linear foot area between Barnhill Road and George Ryder Road. And this plan has been in the works for at least a decade. And as you said, it's been controversial really from the get-go. What it involves is removing a center turning lane, turning the roadway into a two-lane instead of three-lane road, and placing small roundabouts at either end, which are the Barnhill and the George Ryder intersections. Now, it's a $4 million project by the state Department of Transportation. Obviously, Route 28 is a state road. And the town has gone back and forth on it. A lot of people in West Chatham, and including the businesses, have not been happy about it, but the selectmen have stuck with it and said that it's going to improve safety along that corridor.
So what about these gas lines? Yes.
Yeah, the problem comes when, the project's been delayed in the past for engineering and other reasons, but they started it last spring, and this fall they were supposed to start building the roundabouts, and just in the last month or so they've discovered that when new gas lines were installed by National Grid about a year ago, they did not bury them deep enough. And this mistake happened because National Grid was working off the existing grade of the road, but the plans for the new roadway that they're building through there had put the road level more shallow because they need to fix drainage in order to make the whole corridor revised corridor work. So there's about a 900 foot section around near the two roundabouts where the gas lines are 28 inches instead of the 36 inches that National Grid requires. Now, apparently, since those explosions happened in the Merrimack Valley last year, the gas companies have been very adamant about keeping those distances. So what they're looking at is they looked at two possible fixes for this problem. One was to dig up the lines and bury them at the correct depth. We were told by the Chatham Public Works Director Tom Temple that to do that, they'd have to re-engineer the whole area, the gas company, and mm-hmm. then they'd have to actually do the work, and that would take up to 8 months or longer, which officials said is way too long, and it's it would put the project back by at least a year. So instead, what they've opted to do is redesign the roundabout areas and instead raise the level of the road so that those gas lines will meet the 36-inch depth requirement. That's going to require that the engineers on the project recalculate drainage and other technical things, mm-hmm. and that's going to take until at least the beginning of December. And at that point, it'll be too late in the season to actually begin the roundabout work, so that's going to be put off until the spring. So this whole mess really pushes the completion date of the overall project from next fall 2020, into the spring of 2021, and maybe even later, depending upon, you know, obviously there's always weather factors involved here on the Cape. So a lot of people are unhappy about this.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Jeanette Barnes from the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, the Dartmouth School Committee voted this week not to pursue discussions about changing the name of the school mascot, which is the Indians. Some folks, both in the committee and in the audience, weren't happy about this.
Right. So it was a 3-2 vote, and there were definitely people on both sides in the audience when they took that vote. We had another reporter there, so I didn't witness that vote myself, but my understanding is, for example, there was a member of the Pocasset Band of the Wampanoag in the audience who was certainly against not pursuing this discussion any further. There are strong feelings on both sides.
The school had formed this committee to take up the issue, but essentially the committee has said that there's no reason to go further with that. Is that right?
That's what the committee said in that vote. After that meeting, I interviewed Cheryl Andrews-Maltese, who is the chairwoman of the Aquinna Wampanoag tribe. A couple of people in the on the school committee had the impression that she was in favor of using the name Indians and the mascot as it is.
And she actually attended Dartmouth High School in the 70s, right?
Right. So she attended Dartmouth High School, and she and other members of her family at that time helped redesign the logo. So they were using an image of the Dartmouth Indian that was very cartoonish and stereotypical at that point. And I understand it was also kind of geographically inaccurate. Like it had, it was dressed in a way that was not a Wampanoag Indian. So they redesigned the logo. At the time, she said it was a really significant improvement, and she had said that publicly, I think. So people thought that she was in favor of it. But when I spoke to her, she said, actually, times have really changed since then, and she does think that it warrants a kind of a deeper reexamination of whether they should be using that name and image.
What's the sense of where this is going to go? If folks were kind of pointing at her, saying, oh, she's okay with this, and she's saying, actually, we need to reconsider this, what happens now in the community?
Well, that's kind of on my agenda for this week to delve into that a little bit more. But I heard from another member of the Aquinna tribe who says that he wants to work actively with the school district on kind of a cultural education initiative, I think. So I think this really isn't over. And some of the people who voted against the community discussion may have been surprised to hear that Cheryl wanted the discussion. So it's definitely not over.
That's Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times. Jeanette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
And now we're going to the Provincetown Banner to speak with Marianne Bragg. Good morning, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well, Marianne. Thanks for joining us on the show. Wellfleet's police chief is retiring, and he's taking this moment to weigh in on the plan to extend the Cape Cod Rail Trail. You talked to him. He has concerns about this plan.
That's right. This is Wellfleet Police Chief Ron Fassett, and actually yesterday was his last day. But just to give a little background, right now there's a pretty intense discussion in Wellfleet about whether the State Department of Conservation and Recreation should extend the Cape Cod Rail Trail 2 miles more into Wellfleet. And the main issue is the planned intersection at Route 6. So one group says that the design is unsafe and because it brings bicyclists right to Route 6, which is pretty busy. And then the other group says that the design just needs some tweaks right at that Route 6 intersection, some safety tweaks. So given that it is an argument about public safety and that, as it turns out, Chief Fassett is an avid cyclist, it did suddenly occur to me to ask him what he thought about that 2-mile extension.
And what are his concerns? How does he detail them?
He described 3 types of bicyclists. One are the bicyclists who ride along Route 6, who are really fast. The second is what he calls commuter bicyclists, or seasonal workers who are bicyclists, who are just trying to get from one point to the other. And then he described the families who use the rail trail, who he described as not, maybe hadn't been on a bicycle for, you know, a few years. Mm-hmm. But mainly what he said is that the bottom line was that the Route 6 intersection should be avoided altogether, in his opinion, and that the design should really keep the bike trail in the woods as it heads north and not bring bicyclists out to Route 6, mainly because the people who use the rail trail aren't experienced bicyclists.
The chief himself is a very experienced bicyclist, it turns out.
Yes, he just casually said he bicycled like 3,200 miles as of this year. Which
this year.
When I calculated, was like he's biked to Kansas City and back. But, so I actually didn't realize he was a bicyclist so much, but now it's kind of, now that he's retiring, it's come out that he is. So I don't know whether the group that's actually trying to stop this Route 6 intersection, they have a petition with about 1,000 signatures, and they're getting ready to send that to the governor's office to see if they can make some headway on the design.
In your conversation with the chief, he also took this moment as he's retiring kind of to look back on his own career.
That's right. Actually, he was there for 33 years. He came as a summer officer and just stayed the entire time. He spoke about one of the things that he likes about the department is the compassion that he felt like the department has, and particularly where they try to more empathize with what people are going through. They might do something dumb, he said, or silly, but generally he found people to be, decent people was kind of his bottom line.
That is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. On the phone with us now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Made it through the howling winds all right, George. It was quite a night and continues to blow out there.
Yeah, it certainly is. Not what we love to see, that's for sure.
Let me ask you, Martha's Vineyard Hospital is removing the name of Harvey Weinstein from a donor plaque. And this has gotten quite a bit of attention, for one, on your website, judging by the comments there.
Yeah, so, Harvey Weinstein did give a significant donation to the hospital back when it was being built during the Capitol campaign in 2007. And interestingly, the hospital did take down a more prominent plaque that was just dedicated to him that was in the emergency room, but they sort of overlooked that he was on their donor board as well. Someone had brought it to our attention in our comments section, which you mentioned previously, and then again on Twitter. And so I had a reporter check it out, and sure enough, in talking to the hospital, they did some investigating, and they did find his name on that donor plaque and have removed a big section of it. They're planning to remove his name and then put the other donors back up in their place of prominence in the hospital lobby. And of course, listeners know Harvey Weinstein has been accused in the Me Too movement of some significant charges, allegations having to do with sexual abuse of women. So, you know, it is something that, you know, people are concerned about, and certainly the hospital, as soon as they've, you know, found out during their investigation, they took action to immediately remove it from there, and will be replacing that particular panel.
Weinstein has a long connection to the island.
That's right. On some property there, along with some other people, and we hear that he also owned an interest in a pretty popular place called the Hot Tin Roof. So, yeah, he has significant ties to the island. And, you know, it's interesting. This all came up again. People probably have seen that viral video last week where a comedian confronted him. So it is still a very raw issue for people, you know, considering he's still going through the judicial process. Innocent until proven guilty, but, you know, in this case, people have taken action. You know, Hollywood studios have severed ties with him, and a lot of prominent companies have stopped, you know, endorsing him. So there are a lot of people who Harvey Weinstein is a trigger for them, to be sure.
I want to ask you about another story you have this week. It's by Brittany Bowker. It's about how people are ready or not to face an emergency situation, particularly something like a natural disaster. And it's the subject of what sounds like was a pretty interesting talk that's part of an ongoing series on the island.
That's right. You know, we've mentioned this before, where we're trying to take a more detailed look at climate change, as a lot of organizations on the island are. And in this case, they were looking at, you know, climate change means sea level rise, and that could bring on some more powerful storms today or last night, you know, is an example of that. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, even a more significant storm. So are we ready for that? Are we ready for the amount of power outages that could result in the need for a shelter, or even a more significant storm? We've had a tornado threat on the island this year, hurricane threats. You know, what do we do about evacuation? Do we know what our neighbors' plans are? And in this case, this was West Tisbury's emergency management director, Russell Hartenstein, and he was asking these people these questions and trying to get an idea, or put the idea in their heads that they need to start thinking about this, and they need to, you know, have a plan. Talk to their neighbors ahead of time, and, you know, we're going to check on you. So, you know, be prepared that when something happens, we're going to knock on your door and see if you're okay.
One of his suggestions here is that people should register for alerts in their local community.
That's right. There's a thing on the island called Code Red, and all the fire departments and police departments are part of that. And in that instance, when there is something of significance to alert people to, they'll call you up and let you know through this Code Red system. It'll go, there's emails and text messages that'll come out and let you know that there's something of significance, and, you know, you need to pay attention to it. You know, it's a pretty good system. And, you know, as he says, we can only reach the people who sign up for this. So it's on every town website, and it's pretty prominent on them, and big bold letters, Code Red. It's pretty hard to miss.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
It's time now to check in with news at the State House. The future of vape products in Massachusetts is up in the air, with Governor Baker's all-out ban on vape products facing legal scrutiny, and lawmakers considering banning flavors for when the products return to store shelves. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for an update on this and other happenings this week on Beacon Hill.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So, Mike, some changes over this week especially. So where do things stand right now as far as Governor Charlie Baker's temporary ban on vape products?
Yeah, well, basically, it's been going in and out of the court system. Well, it's been in the court system for a couple weeks now. And so basically, the governor had to have a hearing and make an emergency regulation. Before, it was more of just a proclamation that the ban was in place. The judge forced him to kind of go through some of the more necessary steps to have the Department of Public Health declare an emergency and have a hearing on the regulation. So there is something on the books more than just what the governor ordered. It's a little pro forma there, but that is now in effect. And so as of right now, we are still looking at that ban on all vape products until January so that public health officials can study and get a handle on these respiratory illnesses. The evidence suggests that now two people from Massachusetts have died from this mystery illness that is somehow attached to vape products. Both in Massachusetts were nicotine vape products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the public hearing that the judge has mandated will be happening, looks like, November 22nd. And then it also looks like the Public Health Council will reconsider the ban in December. But, we'll just consider that this ban is going to stay in place through January when it will be lifted because it is temporary. Will the same products still be available? Tell us what you think, based on what's happening right now, especially with lawmakers, what the vaping world will look like here in Massachusetts come January.
What's likely right now is that the vape shelves, when the products go back on sale, are going to be a lot less flavorful than they are right now. If you walk into a shop, there's all sorts of different flavors available. Beacon Hill lawmakers right now are pretty dead set on banning all flavors. And that means your fruits, your different kinds of vanillas and things like that that are still available in vape products. Now, flavored cigarettes have been banned for some time now, about a decade. But vape products aren't nearly as regulated yet as that. So I think what we're going to see is a flavor ban at the very minimum. And there's also a lot of talk about adding taxes to these vape products. That's the other piece of the regulatory puzzle that lawmakers are trying to put in place before the end of this ban. So when they go on sale, flavors will be banned, and there will be taxes equivalent to tobacco onto these vaped products coming forward.
I see. So fewer products available. Maybe some stores might have to close their doors for good because of this temporary ban. And then the cost will go up. So will that make them more comparable to the price of cigarettes?
Yes, it will definitely put them in the same category as cigarettes. So people who are, saving a few bucks by vaping now aren't going to get that benefit anymore. And you're right about the shops. I mean, if your primary business is selling vape products and you can't sell them for 4 months, it's likely you're going to go out of business. Another issue that we're hearing here on Beacon Hill is what to do with menthol. That's really where a lot of my reporting this week has been headed.
Yeah.
We don't really know just yet. The idea being, is menthol a flavor? So menthol cigarettes survived the flavor ban of, traditional cigarettes, but will they survive the vape ban and the vape flavor ban? It still remains to be seen. It's a very popular product. A lot of folks use menthol. A lot of folks use it as a step down from traditional cigarettes and as a means to get towards quitting, but it's proving very controversial because a lot of kids smoke menthols too.
And I was also reading this week that menthol has been largely marketed toward people of color and specifically African Americans. So it'll be kind of interesting to see where this leads, given the fact that the Thanksgiving break is right around the corner and they have quite a list of things
Three weeks.
All right. I want to turn now briefly to just a couple more things. There was a group of advocates on Beacon Hill this week, Mike, that were advocating for rent control. And that's a policy that voters opted to ban nearly three decades ago. So what is bringing this back into the spotlight?
Yeah, the brief history of rent control is that only three cities in Massachusetts had it back in the 80s and early 90s. And then in 1994, there was a statewide ballot question that ended up banning it by a pretty small margin. So as you can imagine, those three cities and towns have wanted it back ever since in one way or another. This would allow city municipalities to have better control and to regulate increases in rent. It's a pretty simple concept. What happened this week is there was a big rally saying that the housing crisis and housing prices in greater Boston and really throughout the state is so tight and it's so unmanageable right now that cities and towns need that authority back. Now, sponsors admit that this is going to be a very slow slog. It's going to take many years, if not many legislative sessions, to get lawmakers to sign off on something like this, but they're willing to put in the effort to go forward. And this is something that legislative leaders have kind of already dismissed, at least for this session. So this is a long-term issue to look for.
And finally, just briefly, some lawmakers are already looking ahead at the next election cycle, and that includes House Speaker Robert DeLeo. He wants to continue his stint as the longest continually serving House Speaker in state history by running for another term. What term would this be, Mike?
I don't know. it would probably be 12 or 13, 14 maybe for him as a representative, for him as Speaker. Mm-hmm. This would bring him into his 11th year as Speaker of the House. He took over in January 2009. So he said that this week that he is going to run for re-election in 2020 and then stand for the speakership again in 2021 when Democrats select that. So he basically sent the signals out this week that he's not going anywhere. After this long, after a decade in the top job, there's always a lot of speculation of when's he going to go, when's he going to retire, what's he going to do. There's a lot of people who want to be top dog, but DeLeo was pretty clear this week that he doesn't have any intention right now, but, that might change.
Sounds like folks may not want to make any enemies out of House Speaker Robert DeLeo up there on Beacon Hill, at least for the time being. That is State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Beacon Hill, as he does most weeks. Mike, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The Army Corps of Engineers wants to replace the aging Bourne and Sagamore bridges. And while the proposed plan has received widespread support, it's left open a question about missed environmental opportunities. WCAI's climate change reporter Eve Zuckoff reported that story this week. Earlier, I had a chance to talk with her. Hi, Eve.
Hey, Steve.
Eve, what are the Army Corps' recommendations for the new bridges? Remind us.
Yeah, so the Army Corps is recommending we rebuild these bridges actually much wider. The new bridges would be about 120 feet wide compared to the existing bridge's width of only 48 feet. That width would be expanded in part because the recommendations include a third lane for local traffic going each way. It's called an auxiliary lane. And also the recommendations include a median, shoulders, and a separate bike and pedestrian lane.
And you looked into the unintended consequences of building the bridges this way. What did you find?
Yeah, so according to the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, that replacement plan could lead to a 25% increase in cars coming to the Cape during peak times. So that would be, a summer Saturday. And to explain this, I asked a professor of environmental science and policy. Her name's Susan Handy. She's out in California. And, she said, I would expect that 25% increase to happen. This is a phenomenon called induced travel. It's if you build it, they will come.
And that may be good for tourism and small businesses. So what's the problem there?
Yeah, the more cars on the road, unless they're electric, which is kind of a separate can of worms, the more carbon emissions we pump into the atmosphere. Carbon emissions are the single greatest drivers of climate change. There are real implications of that here on the Cape. So to build a bigger bridge without factoring in the associated carbon emissions, scientists and transportation experts described it to me politely as a missed opportunity to work towards building a sustainable Cape Cod.
What are some of the ideas that are not being considered here?
Yeah, well, to be fair, there will be bike lanes. That's great. But public transit is the big one. Expanded rail service, dedicated bus route, both would require more of a commitment from MassDOT and the Cape Cod Commission to answer the call, down the road once people get here to have more public transit options. But that's a really good place to start because, I think the key in this story is there really are ways to combine equity and sustainability on this that would take us forward, because another lifetime is going to pass before we get another shot at building these bridges in an environmentally conscious way.
There's still time for people to submit comments on this plan. Tell us how they can do it.
Yes. So since our story came out, the Army Corps has extended the public comment period. They can go to CapeCodCanalBridgesStudy.com and tell the Corps directly what they'd like to see on these new bridges.
WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. Big thanks to all our contributors. We heard from Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times, WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan, Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, WCAI's Catherine Iden and Eve Zuckoff, and Mike Dean at the State House. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.